Kia ora, everybody, and welcome to Monday number 32. This is the penultimate Monday. We've only got one more to go. Today, our special guest is none other than Paul Levinson from New York City. Today is in the Northern Hemisphere. It's November the 17th, 2011. Down here in New Zealand, it's November the 18th. It's Wyndham Lewis's birthday, an auspicious day. And today we've got a freestyle conversation with Paul Levinson and what was the omni-notorious Professor Dobbs. So, Bob, take it away.
Paul, would you like to say name a couple of the book titles you've done?
Actually, I'll name every single book that I've ever done. That's even more fun. So let's see. Well, I guess the first one was my doctoral dissertation, which is technically in some kind of book form. That's called Human Replay, A Theory of the Evolution of Media. That was back in 1979. Then I put together a collection of essays. I was really more of an editor, but I wrote a few of them, called In Pursuit of Truth on the Philosophy of Karl Popper. That came out in 1982. Then in 1988, my philosophic pièce de résistance, at least I think so, called Mind at Large, Knowing in the Technological Age. Shortly after that, a collection of essays called Electronic Chronicles, Columns of the Changes in Our Time. That was 1992. Then 1995, Learning Cyberspace, a series of essays on online education. Then in 1997, I started really hitting doubles and triples, to use the baseball metaphor, rather than just singles. So the Soft Edge, A Natural History and Future of the Information Revolution, was published. 1999 was Digital McLuhan, A Guide to the Information Millennium, and also my first science fiction novel, The Silk Code. When we got into the 2000s, my second science fiction novel, Borrowed Tides, my third science fiction novel, The Pixel Eye. That same year, in 2003, I had my next nonfiction book published, Real Space, The Fate of Physical Presence in the Digital Age on and Off Planet. That was followed by Cell Phone, The Story of the World's Most Mobile Medium. Then another science fiction novel, The Pixel Eye. Then another science fiction novel, The Plot to Save Socrates, because I thought Socrates should have taken Crito up on his offer and escaped. I know that's what I would have done. And then last but not least, New Media, published in 2009, which I'm actually working on a revised edition of, even as we speak.
Right, and you also do Facebook, all the social media, right?
Absolutely. I'm constantly on Facebook, Twitter. I'm constantly putting videos up on YouTube. I do three podcasts. I used to do four, but enough was enough already. My record album, Twice Upon a Rhyme, which came out in 1972 and sold a negative number of copies.
You couldn't give it away.
Exactly. It's like somehow like an alternate universe was feeding copies into this one. But it was discovered in Japan in 2002, and it's been reissued on remastered vinyl, and it's on iTunes and Amazon and all those things. So in addition to everything else, I write a song from time to time. McLuhan always said, by the way, that the reason why I understood anything at all of his work was because I was a musician.
That's right.
I had an acoustic sense.
Yeah, when I met you with Mark Stallman in October 98 up in the Borscht Belt, I recall you had been a DJ in the early 70s or something to do with the radio industry, right?
Yes, exactly right. You have a good memory. For a while, I worked with Murray the K. Murray the K on the swinging soiree. That was in the early 1970s. And then right after that with Wolfman Jack. Oh, Paul, the Wolfman here. But
yeah.
I had a lot of fun back then. Those were great little gigs.
Yeah, I met both of them. Now, what year were you born?
1947.
Okay, so you went with Murray the K when he introduced the Beatles. That was too early for you.
No, right, that was a little too early with me. I worked with Murray the K when he came back to New York in the summer of 1972. He'd been out of the New York orbit for a couple of years, and WNBC AM, of all places, invited him to come back and do a show. I wrote an article that was published in the Village Voice, and it actually was laudatory about Murray coming back, but, you know, leave it to editors. I had one line in the article which said, you know, it's great that Murray's back, but he has to do more than just play old songs, because if Murray's not careful, it could become a noose around his neck. So the Village Voice runs the headline, Murray the K in Nostalgia's Noose.
Wow.
Murray at least liked the article, and so he called me up and said, well, how would you like to work for me? And I said, you don't have to ask twice. I even got to meet two Jackies, you know, the original Jackie the K. And
yeah.
Then Jackie Zeman, the new Jackie the K.
Yeah, I'm not sure. If you listen to the long interview with Gerd Stern, I have a 24-hour interview on Dobstown.com. He was a gadfly all over the place. I call him the Forrest Gump of the art world. He was involved with everybody, including McLuhan. And he's on our early mums. You can look him up in the index. He, I think, had a project with Murray the K to start a Warhol kind of dome that would compete with, what was it called, the Electric Circus or something that Warhol had going, or the Dom down the village. They were going to compete with it. I think it was Murray the K that was going to be the figure to draw the investors. Did you ever hear of that project? Out in Long Island, a big place for people to do a disco thing with multimedia.
Yes, I did. In fact, Murray was constantly bubbling over with all kinds of projects, and unfortunately, very few of them got funded or came to fruition. But as you probably know, I mean, Murray, he was much more than a disc jockey. He used to have these things called segues, as he called them, and that was one of the things I helped him do when I was working for him in the early 70s. But back in the mid-60s, when he was on WOR-FM radio, what he would do is he would put together songs that had some kind of connection to each other, which would in effect tell a story, a lot different than just, you know, playing the top hits and just, you know, going randomly from one thing to another. So I mean, he was really deeply into the acoustic world and knew what he was doing.
Yeah, I remember that. They would be records where the story would, okay, the rabbit went over and talked to the hare, and then they'd do Do Run Run or something. A song would come in, a classic song would come in to supplement the narrative, right?
Exactly right. And
yeah.
I even wrote a couple of those for Murray in the 70s, and I had like a Law and Order set where, you know, it started off with the Bee Gees song, I Just Gotta Get a Message to You, you know, the guy on death row and all kinds of other stuff. And it was very good. It was creative radio programming. Murray always felt he was misunderstood, not appreciated, and I think that was true.
Yeah, now that, okay. Now, in Understanding Media, Carolyn, that's my bride, McLuhan talks about the Canadian Murray the K, Dave Mickey. He's the one discussed, the rabbit Finneganese kind of DJ. Do you remember that part of Understanding Media? It's probably in the radio section.
It is in the radio section.
Yeah.
The tribal drum. And in fact, I was just talking about that section at one of the talks I've been giving this year. Over in Europe, about you know, about McLuhan and the fact that the global village that he was writing about in the 60s really was a description of what's going on today. And if you think about the tribal drum, that's, you know, down at Occupy Wall Street, as I'm sure you've probably heard, the brilliant billionaire mayor that we have in New York, Bloomberg, decreed, well, you can't have microphones down there. Somehow that, you know, he objected to the microphone. So what the people down there do is someone says something, and then everyone sort of repeats it, and then the next group. I mean, that's a classic tribal drum. So here, you know, McLuhan's writing in 1964 is literally coming true in 2011.
Okay, have you ever heard, did you ever hear samples of what Dave Mickey did?
No, I don't think I ever did.
Was he known to you in the early 70s? Had you read Understanding Media by then?
I had read Understanding Media, and I read that with interest, but I still never heard any of his work.
Right. So for you, Murray the K is a Dave Mickey of the States.
That's 100% right.
And then Wolfman Jack may be the Old Testament.
Yeah, that would be true. I mean, the truth is, Wolfman was a great showman, but he was nowhere nearly as creative as Murray. He had a great sounding voice, and, you know, he had a sense of, obviously, you know, what great music was, but he was much less cerebral than Murray, and he was much more of a front man than Murray was.
Yeah, listen to this. I spent a decade and a half in Dartmouth, Halifax, Nova Scotia, and I think it would be about 1972 or 3, right when you're getting into the radio industry with Murray the K. A friend of mine had a daughter in the Creighton Park School, like it went up to grade 6. So this was the grade 6ers, and they said they brought in Murray the K. I mean, not Murray, Wolfman Jack. And I said, I had seen him before, but I said, man, I can go see this scene. So I go to this little basement thing in a high school, I mean, a little school, like a, you know, a 50s basement room where you have basement dance, sock hops or something. And there's these little 11 and 12-year-olds, all eager because Wolfman Jack's coming. They don't have a clue who he is, right? And so I stood off of the sideline. He comes out, and he's in with these children, and he's doing his gig. And I'm saying, man, that sure shows the obsolescence of that world of the late 50s. Here it is 12, 13 years later. And he is, like, relegated to talking to 11-year-olds. It was amazing for me.
It is amazing. Well, because he'd become an art form already.
He'd become an archetype, but an archetype only for kids, not for, like, no high school would have him, probably.
No, that's right, because well, that's what happens. Fairy tales were originally adult serious stories, and then they got sublimated into fairy tales. By the way, as far as Murray, one other thing about Murray, I met him in person for the first time. There was a place called Freedom Land here in New York. It was built over, and there's now a housing development called Co-op City there. But this place.
I know Co-op City. I lived there. I lived in City Island for 8 years, right beside Co-op City.
So there you go. Well, Freedom Land, I mean, was basically a losing proposition because they charged too much money for their rides. But at one point, they had a series of concerts. So one day, this must have been like 1963 or 64. I was 16, 17 years old. And I went to Freedom Land because I heard there were going to be some good groups there. And there was this very, very small concert venue. And I got there, and there were maybe just like about 25, 30 people in the audience. And up on stage was Murray the K with the Four Tops, who had yet to really have their first big hit. But
right.
It was like the best concert I ever heard, really.
How old were you, 13?
Yeah, 13.
Is this that little dome place at Orchard Beach?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, I walk there every day. I used to walk over there. It's a lousy beach compared to Hawaii, but anyways, it was a nice place to walk to. And they had a parking, in the 90s, it was a big parking lot, and they used to have a fairground there every once a year that they put up the Ferris wheels. Is that what Freedom Land is, or is it the little dome place?
No, Freeman is actually near Orchard Beach, but it's its own thing. It's
the parking lot behind the dome.
No. I don't know what it was before it was built. Now it's like off Route 95, and it's just like a big housing development. But Orchard Beach was still a magical place. Once I was walking there, also around the same time, with a couple of guys that I was singing with, and we started singing songs, you know, mainly because we were hoping we'd attract them nice-looking girls.
Right.
Which I don't think we did that time. But what we did attract is some guy who started singing with us. And the guy sounded great. I mean, and we were really wailing. And I finally said to the guy, you ought to join, you know, our group. And he said, well, I'm already in a group. And I realized at that instant I recognized his voice. And he said, I'm part of the Highwaymen, you know, the group that sang Michael Rowe,
yeah.
The Boat Ashore. So I mean, this was like Orchard Beach. You never knew who you're going to run into over there.
That's right. It's the Venice Beach of New York, for the Bronx. It's the Venice Beach of the Bronx. Everybody goes out there and struts with their boosters or blasters and everything. You know, this is in the 5-7 years ago when I was there. But you're that little. I'm thinking that little dome place. It's like a mini Hollywood Bowl kind of design, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And so you go there. So did you grow up in the Bronx?
Absolutely. I was born, I don't remember that obviously, but I was born on in a hospital on Tremont Avenue, which is actually just one subway stop down from Fordham University. I lived there the first 3 or 4 years of my life, and then we moved to Arno Avenue and Olinville Avenue, which no one probably has ever heard of, but that's just two blocks away from Allerton Avenue, which became celebrated when rap music first became prominent, because some of the most prominent early rappers came from there.
You mean Flash Jack?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And so I lived there with my parents in the Bronx until I was about 1920 and finally moved out.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I love the Bronx.
So, are you aware of, do you still teach at Fordham?
Yes, I still teach at Fordham.
Okay, so you know of Dan Romanello's midnight show on Saturday, Group Harmony Review?
Oh, absolutely, and Pete Fornatello's show, and
right.
Dennis Elsis has a show now, yeah.
Do you ever go to, do you listen to Dan Romanello?
Occasionally I do, sure.
Yeah, because that show has been going since 1963, and they had a guy on a recent show a few weeks ago. I have a friend download most of them, and I put them on my Dobstown.com site because I call it American DNA, and then the subtitle is Noah's Ark. Because once that show goes, no one's ever going to hear that amazing archive ever again. You know, it'd just be really hard to find.
Yeah.
So I collect as many of his shows as I can. But he had a guy on recently who said in 1962-63, he says Father Trippial or something was approached by a guy who said, let's put on, I have a show with folk music. So that's the big folk, the Oscar Brand and the Hootenanny, 62
right.
period. And so the guy describing this to Dan said that all they had was opera, classical music, and some show tunes. So there's the pop culture for a university public station. So now he mentioned this guy recommends he'd like to do folk music, and the priest accepted it. So this other guy who's talking, Dan, said, well, we got the idea of doing old 50s music, doo-wop. So we approached the father, and he says the father had no clue what they were talking about, what kind of music it was, and he said yes. And so it started like in March 63, this show that's still going. We're at 50 years later, and now it's just an incredible repository of all these collectors from all over that drop in and play like a record by 18-year-olds made once. I mean, they made one record, and that's it. And it's a great record. You know what I mean? Cause
absolutely. I know exactly what you mean. Well, I mean, the 50s were an amazing time. You had all kinds of, groups doing stuff. And
do you know who was the expert and the musicologist of that era? I mean, it's a trick question, sort of, but you should think this, and I bet you don't. The expert, the musicologist, the one who preserved the Noah's Ark was Frank Zappa. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. That's very, very interesting.
Have you ever looked at his first album in 66 called Freak Out?
Yes, and that's a very good point.
You look at that album, the cover, the double sleeve. It was the first concept album, the first double sleeve album. He lists 179, 180 names. He said, these are people who influenced me. Please don't hold it against them. But he has a lot of these 50s groups named in that list, like the Nutmegs and others. But the what?
Yeah, Bob, as much as I was just going to move us back into the orbit of McLuhan, if possible.
It can't be done. Look, this guy walks on Orchard Beach like I do. This is important, Andrew.
I'll bring it back to McLuhan, okay?
Here's
a story that combines McLuhan and the Bronx, all right? It is March 1978. And this is, almost a year after June 1977, when McLuhan's second article on the Tetrad called The Laws of the Media, in those days he had the in there.
Is this when the voicemail happened?
Yes. Well, the voicemail happens a little later.
Okay.
But just to give some context, and so I wrote the preface to McLuhan's Laws of the Media. It was published in Etc. And Neil Postman has been saying we ought to do a conference, you know, Tetra conference with Marshall McLuhan, you know, and Paul, how would you like to help organize it? So I said, sure. But Neil's idea for the conference, Neil Postman, was we would invite Lewis Mumford, we'd invite Jacques Ellul, and I mentioned this to McLuhan, we're already talking, and McLuhan says to me, why the names, Paul? Why the names? Let's just get some graduate students who can talk to me. So I mentioned this to Neil, and Neil says, oh, that's ridiculous. If that's the case, I don't want to do the conference. So
yeah.
I say, well, you know, I tell you what, you know, you don't want to do the conference, I'll do the conference directly with McLuhan. So we organized this Tetrad conference with McLuhan. That took place out in Teaneck, New Jersey. But here's the Bronx connection. The night before the conference, Tina, my wife, and we've just been married for a little over a year, Tina makes this delicious pot roast dinner for Marshall, who comes in with Eric, and Tina and I pick Eric and Marshall up at the airport, bring them over, you know, to our house, which is in the Bronx, and you probably know this, right across the street in those days from Van Cortlandt Park South.
Yeah.
And this is like the building that Tina grew up in. You know, we'd just been living there for a couple of years. And just imagine this. Here in this little apartment, I think it was like on the fourth or sixth floor, who even remembers. I mean, you can almost make a movie of this. Like, you know, zoom in, you have like an overhead shot, and you zoom slowly in like a Hitchcock movie through the window. You see the four of us sitting around a table having one of the best discussions I ever had in my life.
Yeah.
You know, with McLuhan. So Andrew, there's your Bronx McLuhan connection.
That's the beginning. Now, here's the other part. I will claim that I am the only one who was paying enough attention to McLuhan as his potential to be archivist. It was not official at that point. I was the only one who knew that he published in Technology and Culture, I think that's the name of the magazine, in early 74, the first article with Barry Nevitt on causality, and then introduced the Tetrad in there, and then... there was a response, Wilhelmsen responded, and then a couple years later, the Et Cetera article started coming out. And, of course, I was around the coaches. I was the first getting those and Xeroxing them, and no one else knew about them. They weren't interested in McLuhan. So I was the first consumer of these early articles, including yours, around the Tetrad.
Well, I'm very glad to hear about that. And that actually, you know, is a tradition which a lot of my work, you know, continues, and hardly anybody knows about them. So I started that off. But, you know, it was interesting, you know, to think about the way that, you know, McLuhan was just incredibly ignored so soon after he became such a celebrity.
Right.
I'm sure you know about this. I mean, one of the, you know, peak horrendous experiences for me, although it's good material to talk about it, a few months after McLuhan died, so this would be, I guess I'm talking to an editor at St. Martin's Press in January 1981, and I say to the editor, listen, you know, McLuhan has just died. The editor says, yeah, I know. And I said, look, I want to write a book about him, and I think, you know, now would be a very good time to do it. And the editor says to me, well, Paul, you know, McLuhan's time has passed. I said, well, you're completely wrong. And he said, well, no, you're the only one who feels that way.
There's another guy up in Canada, Bob Dobbs. He knows this, too.
Yeah, exactly. I should have. Right. But here's perfect.
Okay, so now we're talking about McLuhan and history, and that's what I want to get into. We did 22 sessions of MUM based on McLuhan and people who knew McLuhan and good commentary and our useful commentary. McLuhan never used the word good. It had to be used the word useful. And then we took a break in August for 6 or 7 weeks. And that break, we called a media fast, was MUM number 23, which had no content because I'm biased towards 22. I don't like the 23 gang. That's Robert Anton Wilson and William Burroughs. So I favor 22, which is McLuhan, because that's 2-run-2. He's from Toronto, 2-run-2. So we didn't have any content for 23. But when we came back with session 24, until now, I declared, and Andrew agreed, that McLuhan, we'd exhausted him. He was actually irrelevant. He could not be applied for the last 30 years to what happened, and that we're going to have to work with Croker. So we've been doing Croker since session 24, 25, and I want to apply the historical memory of McLuhan. And I want to add another point. He totally understood in the late 60s why he would disappear that fast. That's what he was writing about. You know what I mean? He's writing about any intellectual. It's the death of the public intellectuals. Any guy who's some kind of authoritative voice will only get a few minutes in the sun, in the media sun, and go. And he had no problem with that.
Yeah,
you understand
well,
that?
I guess apropos of what you were just saying, McLuhan thought he was going to croak, but it took Croaker to write something about it. But yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah, fuck them if they can't take a choke.
Exactly right. That was Mick Jagger's.
Yes.
All right, so here we go. I just got to establish one more historical point, Bob. Is we've got the transition from Paul Levinson, the musician, to understanding McLuhan. I've got before me, Paul, a letter that McLuhan wrote you in 1977, dated 9th of November, and it looks like you're discussing with him, you're clearly corresponding with him about the Tetrad, like... in around that point. So how did you make that transition from musician to this guy that was into McLuhan?
Well, what happened was this. First of all, I was a musician, you know, all my life actually, but I was working, you know, writing songs, producing records from roughly 1966 to 1972. And as I mentioned before, when my album sold a negative number of copies, I thought I should probably do some other things. So I actually went back to NYU and I completed my undergraduate degree there in journalism. I went on to the New School for Social Research, got an MA in Media Studies where I met John Culkin, and actually I did my master's thesis on McLuhan, and that was like the first and last thing I wrote about McLuhan, which was somewhat stupid. I think everything else I've written is pretty good, but it was basically critical of McLuhan because I didn't really fully get McLuhan even then. But by the time I got to NYU in Postman's program, I'd read McLuhan much more carefully and had come to appreciate him. And the way that I began, you know, writing about the Tetrad and corresponding with Marshall about that has completely to do with another one of these magical moments for me. One day it must have been the fall of 1976, or maybe early 1977, I walk into Neil Postman's office. And he's sitting behind his desk, and Neil often had like a slightly disturbed expression on his face when he was concentrating about something. But he looked more concerned than usual. There was a cigarette dangling out of his hand, almost like a character, well, like Humphrey Bogart in some of his movies. And I say to Neil, "Hey, what's going on?" And Neil slides across the table to me a manuscript. And Neil says, "You know, Paul, I can't really get what this manuscript is about. And, you know, maybe you can, you know, shed some light on this." So I look at it, and the first thing I see on the front page is by H. Marshall McLuhan. And that indeed was the typescript of his second article on the laws of the media. So I read through it pretty quickly, and, you know, to me it was pretty clear what he was talking about. And so I told Postman, and he said, "Well, I tell you what, I want to publish this in Etc., but I'm concerned that our readers won't get it." I don't know why he had such a low opinion of the readers, but he said, "If you could write a preface, I'll publish it before the article. That would be a very helpful thing." So I said, "Absolutely," and I brought that in the next day. What I didn't know, though, is Neil didn't have all that much confidence in me, I guess, because he sends the preface up to McLuhan and proceeds to tell me after he sends the preface up to McLuhan. Now, as egotistical as I've always been, that gave even me a little bit of pause because I'm thinking, here McLuhan has sent an article in to get published, et cetera, on the Tetrad, and some upstart graduate student has written a preface. What's he going to think of that? But it turned out that Marshall, by and large, liked the preface, so that's why the article was published with the preface. Marshall then said to Neil, "I'd like to meet Paul next time I come to New York," and I had a great lunch with Marshall. He said to me at that lunch, "Well, if you're ever up in Toronto, I'd love to have you come by the coach house." So when I got home that night, I said to Tina, "You know, honey, don't you have a cousin in Toronto that we should go up and see?" She said, "Yeah, absolutely." So I then went up with Tina to Toronto, and it was at this, this period of time that, in addition to going up and seeing Marshall, we had these probably as many as 10 or 15 letters writing about the Tetrad. And I was, you know, Marshall, his mind, you know, as Bob knows, his mind was like on 24 hours a day. So, I mean, he would constantly, you know, be scribbling notes and things, and I was always thrilled. You know, again, it was like a scene out of a movie to look at my, you know, mail and see here was a letter from McLuhan, because I always knew there would be good stuff in the letter. One time, by the way, when we were up in Toronto, Tina and I, we go back to our hotel room. We're staying at, I think, the Chelsea Inn, and it's like now about 11:30 at night, and the phone rings. I'm thinking, who would be calling me that late? I mean, we usually stay up until 2 in the morning, but, you know, nobody even knew we were up in Toronto from back home. Well, it was Marshall who was saying to me, Paulio, there's a rerun of the Frost-Nixon interview. It's on right now. You must turn it on. And McLuhan proceeded to give me the best libretto, you know, of what was going on. Well, Nixon, you know, he's gotten it a little bit, not quite as hot as he was in 1960, and, you know, sort of handicapping Nixon in this interview. So it was an extraordinary time for me, and as I often tell people, and I'm sure Bob feels the same way, you know, I've been fortunate enough to have conversations with Isaac Asimov, Karl Popper. I mentioned the book of essays that I had, and you know, these, you know, pretty great minds, but just in terms of the sheer evanescence, you know, effervescence of ideas that were coming out of McLuhan's mind every, you know, time I had any contact with him at all. I'm sure it was happening with everybody else. There's never been anyone who's even been close to that. So,
yeah, Paul, in Stephanie McLuhan's documentary in 1984, they have Norman Mailer saying he used to think that he was the fastest mind in the West, but when he met McLuhan, he says, no, he couldn't keep up with McLuhan. Remember that quote?
Yes, I do. That's a great quote. McLuhan had the quickest wit. Look, you and I mean, you might be better than me. I mean, I'm happy if I come up, like, even like in this conversation we're having now. So I've come up with a couple of good lines. You've come up with a couple of good lines. If McLuhan would pause this conversation, every other word out of his mouth would have been a great line. You know?
That's right. He really, you could look at him. The artist has perfect pitch. You knew he was right because he had this open field of energy, the Niagara Falls, and that's what the real great artists have, and no one else could approach it. So you knew he was the one living in the present.
Yeah, there's an interesting thing in this letter. I'll just quote it because I think it's a nice sort of counterpoint is here. It says, this is McLuhan to Paul. He says, the Tetrad gets one off the triad hook and anchors investigation and observation in the common sense world. The triad people, on the other hand, seem to be passionately devoted to escaping from the common sense world in the name of science and elitism. So while he's this genius, super fast mind, he seems to be always pressing back to the common, back to the everyday, back to the present.
Yes, and it's actually also, and I was actually talking about this with a couple of people, I think it was at the McLuhan conference in Brussels a couple of weeks ago or last month, and that's the progressive evolutionary aspect of the Tetrad, the four-part structure, in contrast to the profoundly conservative and self-enclosing quality of the Tetrad. Because triad, right? The dialectic. Because basically, you know, the dialectic ends with this, you know, the synthesis. You know, everything is like pulled together, and that basically is not moving anywhere really significantly forward. Whereas the Tetrad, after you go through the first three effects, flips into something else. And by the way, I always like the flip into usage much better than reverses into, because although reverses is true enough, it can easily be misunderstood as going backwards. And,
yeah.
But the essential part of flipping into is it pulls in the retrieval, and in that sense, it's a little backwards, but it flips into something new. And that, I think, is a profoundly evolutionary, revolutionary aspect of the Tetrad. And yes, it is something that is grounded in the world of reality, in contrast to the world of abstract thinking, because philosophy can't handle flipping into something. In other words, it's almost beyond philosophy to deal with that.
Beyond visual space. Here's a word you may not know that McLuhan uses. It's hebdomadal, H-E-B-D-O-M-A-D-A-L, which means every 7 days. It's cyclical. It's hebdomadal. That's never been said before, but he talks about Baudelaire's hebdomadal sensitivity, and he had a seminar in Paris or wherever, 1850s. It was hebdomadal. Note that word. It's hebdomadal. Because remember, the quadrivium and trivium are seven arts. So you can take the four and add the three, and you got seven. So I'm just adding a point you may not have thought of.
No, that's a very good point. I mean, so the four and three are complementary.
Yeah.
McLuhan actually at some point did a tetrad on the tetrad, and it sort of gets into that. One of the things, by the way, that I did, and I one of these days I'll get back to it, although I've been saying this since late 1970s, I actually began mapping out what I call spirals of tetradic evolution. And what I mean by that is when you think of the flip into, what that flips into, the result of that is not just going back to the beginning, to what's enhanced,
yeah,
but to something above and beyond it. So it's not a wheel. It's not a circle. It's a spiral which keeps spiraling into the future.
Well, that's what I have, Paul, in my tiny note chart, which is the supplement to the formula chart. I call it Orphic Baroque Spirals from 1977 to 1990-92, and I have the different quadrants. But that is Baroque Spirals, which then goes into not the hologram, but the anamorphic. Do you know the word anamorphosis?
No, tell me what it means.
Croker is the one who first talks about it, and he may have gotten it from Baudrillard, but I don't see Baudrillard doing much on it, but Croker develops it a lot. Anamorphosis is the trompe-l'oeil, the visual trick that began in Mannerist painting, in the 1600s.
Mm-hmm.
It's M.C. Escher is a good example.
Oh,
you know
yeah,
how the spiral is going up and down?
Yes.
People don't realize that the tetrad is anamorphic also. And when you then bring in the fact that machines come alive, which is what McLuhan says in 1968 in War and Peace and Global Village, they become organic, the machines, they come alive, they start doing the tetrad, I say, from the pentadic level. And the only guy to write about the pentad is Frank Zingroni. He proposed that as a counter to McLuhan's tetrad, to McLuhan himself. But McLuhan sort of just held back and stayed with the tetrad. Anyways, the pentad, the android meme, comes alive and does the tetrad as a content. And that's really anamorphic. Okay, so that's
I like that. That's very good. By the way, Eric is the conservative influence, for better or worse, on what happened with the tetrad. Because
yeah,
if you look at what, right, because so sadly, Marsh McLuhan dies, and then Eric becomes sort of the custodian of the tetrad and the person who puts out the actual book. And it's not at all clear to me that had Marshall lived, that that Marshall wouldn't have gone with some of Zincronis and some of the other elaborations of the tetrad.
Well, the two authorities on that were Barry Nevitt and George Thompson. George Thompson was McLuhan's assistant. He witnessed that. He has a lot of stories about what really happened in the making of the tetrad, which doesn't totally agree with Eric, and neither did Barry Nevitt. I mean, Barry Nevitt said that he discovered it with the Marshall. So unless Eric was here, I won't say any more. I mean, I'm willing to have Eric come in and talk about it, but I've got information based on Barry and George Thompson. I think Thompson even talks about it on our early MUM a little bit. So, yes, it's lost in the midst of manipulation, and the best thing is to move into the pentadic and the anamorphic, because the New Agers, they go towards the hologram, which is really a version of visual space, the macro and the micro.
Yes.
And everything here is also out there. That's still within a visual space situation. And I want to say this, since I might not get a chance to say it later. Figure ground is to look at things as figure ground is visual bias. Now, to prove this, you go into explorations number 8, Verbi Vocal Visual, where he has many items, Marshall numbers them. One of them is about the beginning of the printed book effect and how the novelists began to look, or the beginning writers, then they became novelists, would see a figure and a background. To see a figure and a background is what comes in with visual space, with the printed book effect. Tribal people don't see figure ground. He shows in They Became What They Beheld, they see both at the same time, and then there's always another figure ground. And so figure ground, if it's only looked at as visually, you haven't even begun to see what McLuhan's talking about, because it's multi-sensory figure ground. You get what I'm saying?
Well, 100%, and that's what I was getting at before when I said, you know, that you must be literate if somebody said you're schizophrenic. But
right.
This gets back to what McLuhan says in the Gutenberg Galaxy and other places, that it's alphabetic literacy that gets us to focus on visual space the way you're talking about it.
Yes, to see, figure, ground.
That's
yep.
Right.
But here's the thing.
There is no figure ground in the acoustic world. It's just a completely, you know, different situation.
It's rhythmic, resonant interval, and probably smells and all kinds of wacky non-visual stuff, including hallucinations or what wouldn't be perceived as hallucinations. Just anything that you experience, they're just sensations. But back to this, the figure ground. So Marshall brings up figure ground. So you got to look at McLuhan. When he writes a book, he's fully aware of the dynamics of the effect of that visual bias, and so he embeds an antidote to it as much as possible in the book, like Joyce did with Finning's Wake. And so the best way to get the visual biased person out of the hypnotic effect of the printing press is to begin to make them aware of figure ground. You see what I'm saying?
Yes,
that's how you begin.
Yes, and that's precisely also why he deliberately wrote in such a non-orthodox way as far as scholars and academics are concerned. That's why the academics couldn't get Understanding Media, couldn't get Gutenberg Galaxy. They were looking for nice, neat chapters, each about 30, 40 pages in length.
Okay, but now, Paul, you've walked right into it. Now, this is what you don't know, and this is probably one of the first times I've had a chance to say it. I've said it here and there, obscure places. What nobody gets, and probably neither yourself, is that those books are novels.
Yeah, no, I that's a very good point. I'm not at all surprised. I think of those books as songs, actually.
Yeah.
And then just to put another layer on this to bring this into the current age, if you look at the Gutenberg Galaxy, if you think about what you're reading there, you're reading a series of tweets. That's what the glosses are. And then the so-called chapters, the content of that are blog posts. And so that is what McLuhan was writing in 1962, before there was even a computer screen that looked anything like we know it now.
But where did he get that from? He was just building on his predecessor, and what was that?
Well, what he got it from, this I've given a lot of thought to, what the digital age is and what McLuhan was talking about is calling on a profound aspect, a central aspect of human communication. And McLuhan was calling upon that, despite the world of books and television and radio that he lived in, to communicate about.
Okay, wait a minute, Paul. No, I agree with that, but you're missing the point.
Okay.
He was just updating Finnegan's Wake.
Yes,
Finnegan's Wake
yes.
is the digital novel. Don Field got famous in the 90s pointing that out to people. So here he is, all the tweeting and all that, tweeting and Facebook and blogging, it's all in Finnegan's Wake. And he used to teach way back in the early 50s that Finnegan's Wake was not a book, it was a radio program. But later he could see it included later digital developments. So here, how does Marshall build on the death of the novel and the achievement of Finnegan's Wake? You can see it in... it's like around page 160 of Cliched Archetype, where he talks about Ulysses was about a particular figure that absorbs all the dimensions of media, which is a replay of the movie medium, contains all media, the movie. But Finnegan's Wake, it does not have any psychological connectives, no individual characters. It's dealing with a corporate image. And so you've got to write a novel beginning with what Finnegan's Wake had started with, which is corporate images talking, corporate media talking to each other. Later he would say the media are actors. And how does he do it? When a Mechanical Bride comes out, you can see in the letters, he writes to his mother, who is his mentor, his guru, and the whole crux of the biscuit. He writes to his mother and said, Mom, I've made a new kind of novel. It's a science fiction novel where the characters are the ads and the comics. You see, that's the figures.
That's
the
right.
Actors are the ads and the comics. So look at Mechanical Bride as an avant-garde novel.
That's completely right. And it certainly looks like that. But one thing, maybe you can shed some light on it. You probably noticed, at least when I knew McLuhan, he was always apologizing about The Mechanical Bride, whereas I thought it was a great book and still do think it's a great book. And, you know, the pictures are brilliantly chosen and McLuhan's observations are really on key. Did you get any of that from McLuhan, that he somehow was, for some reason, not happy with The Mechanical Bride?
Yes, on this level. First of all, he was up. He was sick and tired of people by the 70s. He had no clue what he was doing, and that was draining on him. But he still persevered and carried on making his discoveries. I mean, Barry never tells the story. What would you do, Marshall, if you died and found that you were still conscious after you died? He said, plunge ahead. All right? So he was plunging ahead in the 70s after he'd been famous and then killed by the media, which was a natural cycle. So here he is. He is a playwright, and Andrew Crystal points this out in his thesis. He is a playwright after the novel of Mechanical Bride. So whenever he's doing a book, it's a novel. Gutenberg Galaxy, understand media. But he's not just a novelist. He's a musician and a playwright, and he's always looking for the opportunities to start running the global theater on a management level with satellite and computers. That would be a massive play, but if he could never be allowed to do that, he was always looking to put on a Broadway musical. And so he's apologizing to the baby boomers. He knows you're dramatically tribal and tactile and post-tribal and para-autonomous, all those factors of the satellite effect. And so to be a mere novelist, he's apologizing to you because he's also aware that young people are pick up the rhythms of the present, just like the tribal people would do, look at the young people, see what's going on. So he always thought that you guys, the younger people, were more aware than him. So he always thought that you guys had biases. He knew you were looking at him askance. He's just an old geezer, right, who writes essays or something. And so he's very self-conscious of you guys perceiving more than you would let on that he to him that you knew. So you get what I'm saying? He's addressing the more aware baby boomer and saying, no, don't worry. You like Andy Warhol? You like Zappa? Don't worry. I'm right in there. I apologize if I was known for writing a book. Forget that. I'm here to perform.
Yeah. That's a very good explanation, and of course, you know, part of that is why he took such delight in the impromptu words that he said in Annie Hall, because there, at least for those few minutes, he was able literally to give a performance.
Yes, and Mark Stewart, who I knew well, had incredible stories. Marshall was, when he came back, he wanted immediately, like a little kid, we got to make movies. He couldn't get over being in a movie. He wanted to make more movies, and he just wanted to get into it. And you know who he eventually met that was going to satisfy that was a man named David Greenberg, who I met here in Maui 3 years ago through Mary McClune, who was an old friend of his. David Greenberg, this is not in the biographies, no one knows it, but he's got the documents and the materials to prove it. In 77, 78, he was hanging out with Mary. He meets Marshall. And then he, because he's a big dude in L.A., he can get Marshall on the local PBS kind of station, whatever it is in L.A., and he says, we can do a Jacob Bronowski. I can make you have a 10-program series. And so Marshall secretly got into this project of moving to L.A. and making this TV series and getting to a new medium. Okay? Nobody knows about that. And one night, David tells the story, Trudeau phoned, because Trudeau would often, and he was still prime minister then, he would often want to come to Toronto and hang out with Marshall. So it would be like, hush, hush, can I stay at your place overnight? Well, there's David watching Marshall saying, no, Pierre, I don't want you to come today. I have other things to do. He rejected Trudeau dropping in because he was more interested in this L.A. project. And so that is like the frustrated McClellan. He would have liked to have done that in the 50s or 60s, get on TV, do all the stuff. But finally he found someone who had access to do it. But then Marshall, you know, dropped off shortly after that. Within the year, he had a stroke.
Yeah.
So, and we have it on record. Andrew and I have talked about it. He says in 1970, I got a couple more books, and then that's it. No more books. That's in 1970. He said, I'm going into movies and other media. So because of the lack of understanding of what he was about or what he meant, and actually, many people made millions ripping him off and making crummy B-grade programming, you know what I mean? But he could have done A-grade or at least avant-garde amateurish, whatever it would have been. It would have been anti-environmental. And that's the untapped resource of McClellan. So Beaujard is right to say McClellan was primarily a musician, but I add that he was a playwright and a novelist. And that throws a whole new light on why he was so detached about his theories, about how detached about being an academic. He was not limited to that.
I think that's a very, very good point. Personally, people often ask me, well, how can you write science fiction and music and nonfiction about media history and, you know, media in general at the same time? And I always say to them, it's easy because they're the same thing. In other words, the writing of science fiction, of music and media theory are really almost identical in many ways.
Under electric conditions.
That's right.
Under electronic conditions, by the 70s, you can say that.
That's right. That's right.
Right. They're the same thing.
Yeah. I would say that McLuhan was prouder about those lines in Annie Hall than just about anything else that he did in his life. I mean, he would beam from ear to ear when he would be talking about it.
Well, he summed it all up. To get on that, can you imagine Einstein or Darwin or Galileo saying, "My fallacy"? You know, there's the satire. There he is. He's not identifying with being just a philosopher. He's saying, "You think my fallacy is wrong. You think my whole fallacy is wrong." The point is, it was already a fallacy because it was limited to what he said with his mouth. The mouth was such an obsolete medium in modern society, electronic conditions, that if Marshall was known for what he said, he knew that's not what he was about. He was way beyond the verbal. So only people were dealing with the fallacious part of Marshall, what he said, global village and the medium is the message. You see what I'm saying?
No, that's 100% right. And I'm sure you've seen the really wretched, but I mean, it's almost funny, it's so bad, the interview that Marshall gave to Tom Brokaw and Edwin Newman. It was, I think, right around the time Jimmy Carter was running for president. And you could see how frustrated he was, Marshall.
Yeah.
They didn't get, actually, Edwin Newman was not bad. Tom Brokaw, I mean, I whatever respect I may have had for him as a news anchor, I lost when I saw that interview again recently.
You know what he called? He said about those guys. First of all, is that music in your background or Andrew's? What's that
not
noise?
My background.
Yeah, it's not noise. Okay, I hope it doesn't come in too much. Okay. What Marshall would say about Tom Brokaw and Mike McManus, I think the guy in the TV Ontario interviews in the late 70s, he said, "Rather wooden."
Right. They were like Charlie McCarthy.
Yeah. Rather wooden. And that's what Brokaw meant. They come across as wooden. But that great interview, which is September 1976 after the Carter-Ford debate, McLuhan says, "The medium rebelled against the message and came alive and turned it all off and disrupted it."
That's right.
There's the Android meme. That's machines coming alive. And, you know, he would say things like that, and no one would even notice it. They'd just say, "Oh, the guy was on. McLuhan came down, and he said a few things." They wouldn't even notice the outrageous, fallacious, or science fiction quality of what he was saying.
Well, that's exactly right. That's what I was alluding to before. McLuhan was incapable of saying anything without making some kind of brilliant, subversive, totally overturning the apple cart of preconception.
Of the moment, of the situation and people who was interacting. He was a dramatic, manipulative satirist, not just in writing and speaking, but with whoever he was with.
That's right. And that's, by the way, why, you know, I was mentioning this to Andrew earlier. If you think about what's going on in Occupy Wall Street, and the media, the old media, say, "Well, you know, what are your demands? You know, what do you want?" And the Occupy Wall Street people say, "Well, you know, we can tell you what we want, but basically we're here. That's what's going on." So, I mean, if there ever was an example, you know, the medium is the message. They're just being there is what's having the impact. The idea of, you know, what is your demand? That's like asking for a headline, which is what newspapers, you know, want, or it's like asking what the lead story is for a television newscast. But that's another example of how, and it's not as if the people in Occupy Wall Street have read McLuhan, but they are, in many ways, I think, embodiments of what McLuhan was talking about.
Okay, now, Paul, now we're going to get, Andrew wants us to get into the meat. We're going to get into the present. We're going to do Occupy Wall Street. But I anticipated this, and I have a way of coming at it where we're not going to use McLuhan at the beginning. We're going to use Croker and what the occupiers are up against. But I just want to see, was there some other point? We were just talking about McLuhan, the manipulating, and he was on the TV. Oh, yeah. Have you seen, it just got posted on our site, the old French TV thing in the early 70s, de Kirchhoff sitting there beside McLuhan, of McLuhan talking to the great French composer Pierre Schaeffer. Have you seen that?
No, I'll definitely see it. I'd love to see it.
Here's what to look at. What you have is you have a woman translating Schaeffer, but you can hardly hear her. You have Derek translating McLuhan, who's speaking in English. And then you have like some voiceovers translating it all. So it's all garbage. It's all mixed up. But you catch little statements by McLuhan. But here's the thing. Watch his face. You will see him look like a little kid who says, oh, I know I'm being bad. I hope no one's noticed it. You see that look. Then you see the solid literary man talking to the acoustic composer. Then you see the guy who says, well, you know, you don't understand anything. Watch the flitting of selves and characters across McLuhan's face. It's probably possible because you can't fully understand the verbal content. So this is a tremendous document of McLuhan rapidly shifting quadriphenically or doing tetrads with the person he's talking to, tetradically responding, flipping, being submissive, then being dominant, then being arrogant, then being pleading. Watch that, Paul, when you go into it. Okay, I just want to point that out. Now, here we are. McLuhan is a historical image. So I take Croker's book, Data Trash, page 137. You ever looked at that book?
Yes, I haven't read it, but I glanced at it.
Okay, so here I am at page 137. He says, there are no longer any historical trends, only the disappearance of history into recombinant spectacles across the galaxy of the media. No longer, now listen to this, we're talking about the cyclical and the tetrads, the cycle, no longer the division of time into durational cycles of past, present, and future, but into what Spengler has described as the premonitory shadow of, in quotes, contemporaneity. Contemporaneity, right?
Whatever, yeah.
In recombinant history, everything can be retrieved and rendered contemporaneous so that the contemporary loses all meaning. History is resequenced as a fashion file. Virtual history consists of two primal movements, making everything available for digital archiving and manipulating the archive into new and ever more creative recombinations. Consequently, the historical coda for the recline of the West, or the recline of McLuhan, here's the historical coda for the recline of the West, colon, the retreat of the electronic population into fantasy worlds where bodies are prepped for virtualization by being saturated with recombinant images. Then he begins a whole bunch of stuff on telematic history itself, and I'm going to quote from that eventually, but taking that, this very statement that Croker's saying is what the occupiers are up against as a media phenomenon, all right? This is what they're up against. Now, we did a whole series a couple of weeks ago on MUM where I explained, I'll just summarize it, that the reason the occupiers have no respect for the older media or any media is that they are not trying to tell us something. They are trying to turn the living form of the human into a living museum. They are retrieving the basic nature of communication, which is ESP, or nonverbal gestural contact. They are presenting, this is my summary statement, they are presenting human ESP as a nostalgic retrieval of Web 2.0 in response to Web 3.0.
Well, I agree with that for the most part. I mean, I would put it in slightly different...
Go ahead. Put it in your... Translate me. Translate me.
Well, first of all, one of the things... Remember I mentioned that I wrote a book called Real Space, The Fate of Physical Presence in the Digital Age. That was one of the first times I made the point, which I think is becoming increasingly relevant now with Occupy Wall Street, that it's a mistake to look at the virtual and digital as in some sense abstract from and unconnected to the real, the physical, the palpable. That, in fact, the two are integrally intertwined. And what happens in the digital age, what happens on the digital plane, inevitably has profound consequence in physical, flesh and blood situations.
Well, who would not know that? I mean, that would not be understood in the 80s, but who would not understand that today?
Today, yes, but in 2003, there were people who were saying, oh, we're getting lost in cyberspace, you know, we're losing our connection to reality. But the point about Occupy Wall Street is, and the same is true of the Arab Spring, is it's instigated, in terms of just a logistical matter, it's basically initiated through social media. So calls go out on Twitter, Facebook to meet, and that's how. And it was a Canadian organization that basically began this, you know, just a couple of months ago. So it's initially something which exists in the digital realm, but now really for the first time in a very, very long time, much more important than the digital realm is what's actually happening, the fact that there are physical bodies right there. So that's why when you were saying they are, in effect, negating all media. I agree with that. They're not interested in newspapers. They're not interested in really being interviewed for television. What they're interested in is being there. The part of the media, though, that they are still connected to, because that's what gave them birth in the first place, is the digital age, is the video that can go up on YouTube and be seen around the world instantly, the tweet, the Facebook status page. And the reason that they're interested in that is because they understand that those things can be instantly universal, global, and most importantly, and this is one of the things I go into in New Media, there are no gatekeepers to these kinds of digital media. There's no editor who can decide I don't want to do that. There's no producer who can mangle something. There's no even reporter who can get it wrong. And as you and I know, Bob, how many times have we ever been quoted in an article where the quote reflects what we actually said? So I mean, the quote is inherently distorting. And the new media world, not the new media world, because new media are Amazon, iTunes, which even though they're online, they still operate in traditional, hierarchical, top-down fashion. But Twitter and Facebook and YouTube and other like media, they don't have any gatekeepers. There's no one there to decide what goes out. Anything can go out. And so that's why, really for the first time in 2011, we've seen the feeding back in of the digital media age into the palpable and physical. And when you said ESP, that's exactly right, because it is the same as ESP, because the information can move so quickly. It can move without obstruction. And that, by the way, to look at least one very ugly part of this, that's why the police are so frightened by this. It's not that there are any crimes going on there. It's that the police and the mayors and the political powers that be are frightened by this, because they correctly see it as a profound movement in direct democracy. And they, the mayors and the police and all the elected officials, they are from representative democracy, which in turn are fed by secondhand representative media, such as newspapers and traditional mass media like television and radio.
Okay. Okay, finish up. Go ahead.
Well, so that's what I see happening right now before our very eyes.
I'm going to make it better. Are you aware of my five-bodied model?
No, I'm not.
Okay, there's what we call real space, the physical body. I call the chemical body, because the Western paradigm that started with the, 1850, with the interior passage and the chemistry inside the body, the mapping of that with microscopes, that model comes through a modern science, is what we map onto the physical, okay? So it's a human projection, a cultural projection on the physical. So I'm calling that the chemical body. And then I say there are cultures and views that there's more than the physical. So all the literature about that is the astral body literature, or you can call it spiritual or religious. There's more than what we see, okay? So there's a whole bunch of media on that. And then you have the TV landscape, or what McLuhan called the discarnate man. Then you have the chip landscape. Now, the digital has gone around all four and shrunk the TV landscape into, it's a little organ you have, or it's a body. You've added a TV body to yourself. And the chip body itself has shrunk itself from a landscape. The chip landscape has shrunk itself to chip body. So you take these four bodies, the chemical, the astral, and mainly chemical and astral are literary manuscript repositories. You know what I mean? Then you have the archive of the TV world and the archive of the chip body. The intermingling of these, like a tetrad, underneath a fifth force, which is the pentatic resolution caused by the Android meme and technology and machine coming alive, is the real vortex. You have these four bodies, and then I add on the mystery landscape, which is saying these four bodies are what we know now, but there could be more. There could be more than that, and so we'll include that as what we don't know. It's like Donald Rumsfeld. We know what we don't know, but we don't know what we don't know. Remember that stuff?
Yes, I remember very well.
Right. Okay, so he's intuiting the mystery landscape. Okay, so you got these four bodies. Now, we can resolve some of the way you said it by saying there's a when I say that the Occupy movement or the Arab Spring is nostalgia for the living museum of the human form, when you talked about an hour ago about the basic essence of the communication that Marshall was tapping into, remember how you tried to define that?
Yes.
The core meaning of what is being communicated between humans. I'm calling that ESP, or just the matching. It's like in Finnegan's Wake, the first page 16, you see Jut and Mute get together. Joyce archetypalizes two people interacting, and there's all kinds of multisensory interactions going on. And the nonverbal, the preverbal, the postverbal, I lump into what we call mental gesture or ESP. So we extended that with the electric age. So you have the Arab Spring and occupiers. They want to, they have a nostalgia for human communication, the basic, whatever you call human contact. Mm-hmm. Okay? So they gather together. Now that appears to be nostalgia for the chemical body, but it's not. It includes the nostalgia for the chip body, especially Web 2.0, because Web 2.0, as Miroslav Bytes explained to us a couple weeks ago, to Web 2.0 allow people to share the same place as they interacted, emailed each other. You didn't do that in Web 1.0. You're all in your little bunker and you email each other in a common chat group. But when everybody's sharing 24/7 the same space, it's kind of like an ESP, right? Everybody's in touch with each other. And the kids are addicted to that through their texting. So that shared space of the Web 2.0 technology, Twitter, YouTube, and that, and Facebook, that is being obsolesced by a new environment, which is Web 3.0. And Miroslav defined that as basically the bots can go around and find all the stuff that no one knows how to categorize and serve it up to you. So I see Web 3.0 as the situation where you will be a solipsistic god where everything is served to you, and you can massage it any way it's possible you want to, you come up with. The connecting with people, which was the hyper phase of the last 5 years, people trying to connect and exchange the electronic ESP, that is being superseded by the non-connecting and the swallowing the whole world. Now, if you read McLuhan's review of Burroughs' Naked Lunch and the Nova Express, 1964, Nation Magazine, December, you will see him say that the electronic age is largely Egyptian, where the artist programs the whole world as his content. So I cite that as McLuhan intuiting the pharaonic, the Egyptian nature of Web 3.0. So as always, every new technology, the human bodies respond immediately. So Occupy spreads all over the world because it's nostalgia for the connecting of human communication through the digital body known as Web 2.0. It's a reaction to the ultimate fragmentation and overlapping of Web 3.0. It's going to end up, Web 3.0 gets you more into the Matrix, as it was shown with Neo. He's living in New York City and working in the office and all that, and that was all in his own virtual tube, right? He was on his own little tube. Mm-hmm. Now, you could say that's the way Web 1.0 is, or Web 2.0, but actually, Web 2.0 goes beyond Neo's Matrix because everybody can share and be in touch with each other. And maybe that's what was meant by the Matrix. It was a sharing because people seem to share the realities. But the ultimate fragmentation, or what I don't know what you call it, black-holing of everybody, ass-holing and black-holing of everybody in Web 3.0. I'm taking the McLuhan method. This social phenomenon is not what the people doing it and the people covering it understand. They do not even know what's being expressed here. And so I'm saying that the reason you were talking about the older media versus the digital media, no. These people, everyone is juggling the four bodies. It's a later phase of the chip body, maybe moving into the mystery landscape, Web 3.0, that allows people to gather, to stand there and say whatever they want, chemically free expression of points of view, but no, that's not the agenda, not even to be acknowledged in the regular media. That's the old TV body landscape and the old chemical body landscape like newspapers. That's acknowledged, but not the whole story. And then on top of that, they're using their chip body to be in touch with each other. And then they're just saying, we are. And it is a huge museum that's being made. And I say the more the people don't understand that, then you might have what may have happened right today. What's going on in New York today? Did they cross the bridge? Did the riots start?
Well, last I heard, they were on the bridge. There were no actual riots. There were like 180 people, some odd people were arrested. I haven't checked in the last hour, so.
Okay, so there you have. See the what you have now with the cleaning up of the occupied spaces. Now, what did Bloomberg and them wait for? They waited for chemical body symptoms, disease, Zuccotti lung. You know what I mean? They started to wait. They're going to look at go for the chemical body thing because everybody misinterprets this as the physical, real space or chemical body being setting up a confrontation. And the people think that we say we're people, we're 99% of us, we're human beings, that'll be an Esperanto for people all over the world, and people will gravitate around it. And they do. But it also can be used against them on the chemical body level by saying, you guys are not hygienic, there's diseases growing up here. Okay, so they clean it out, and they have a few articles saying how disgusting the place was, like the garbage men like were puking almost, the mess. So that's probably propagandistic or distorted. But it's still there. And now the Zuccotti, they're hoping the chemical bodies will gather and rush back in there and claim the space. All the time performing for the old TV landscape or TV body and the chip body. And it's the juggling of these four that is the more articulate way to describe the factors that will undermine both Bloomberg and the occupiers and the TV body and the chip body. This is like a perfect storm. You see what I'm saying? But you got to look at it as the four bodies.
Well, I do, and I like most of that. The only point, as a significant point, that I would not agree with, first of all, I agree completely, obviously, about, the older, media and
yeah. They're on the sideline, but they are part of our bodies. They are the old TV body.
That's what the old TV buys. I mean, Fox News today proclaimed that Occupy Wall Street is dead. Fox was actually just looking in a mirror and proclaiming its own death. Fox News is dead. But so I agree with all that. I mean, that's brilliant analysis. The one point, however, and this is something where I disagreed with McLuhan to some extent about, and I disagree with almost everyone about, is I'm more optimistic, with
now, what does that mean? Which body are you optimistic for?
The aspect that you're talking about the chemical bodies and Occupy Wall Street communicating to the chip body, and how you ended up by saying we don't know where that's going to go. Is it going to go into the mystery body? And in effect, you're to put it in Tektratic terms, you're saying it's going to flip into I don't know what. I think I have an idea of where it's going to flip into and where it's headed. And that,
okay, say it. Say it.
Okay. It's headed into a resurgence of direct democracy, to give the political aspect to it. And you should agree with this. It would have aspects of the chemical body because there is this physical component of it, but it will also have very important aspects of the chip body. The least significant part of this new realm will be the television body, or what I think of as the representative body. And although I couldn't say exactly what form that's going to take, I think that combination, which is fundamentally, again, in Tektratic terms, it's the chip body retrieving the chemical body, I think that combination can result in one of the most glorious ages that human beings have ever enjoyed, an age which will be much more and truly global than it ever was before, but will nonetheless have, by today's and yesterday's standards, a profound capacity to get into local situations, because again, the physical body is going to be more important. It's going to be an age in which elected governments are going to be less important, when decisions will be made through voting, or whatever it's called, through the chip body or the digital age. And I think it'll be exciting and fun to see where that resides. Because at the basis of most of my optimism, and I don't know whether you would agree or disagree with this, but I think people are inherently rational, inherently intelligent, inherently creative. I can't remember, I think it was Julius Simon was his name, who about 10 or 15 years ago said, he's against population control because that would curtail the greatest human resource, which is the human mind, the human brain. And the more human beings we have thinking, the better off we are as a species in terms of dealing with problems on this planet and, for that matter, out into the cosmos.
Okay, now, Paul, what you're saying happened in the 60s. You're sounding like a humanist, literate throwback, celebrating the counterculture in the 60s, and McLuhan was seen as a cheerleader for that, but he wasn't. Okay, I'll say it this way. We could take recently, Mark Stallman posted on the Media Ecology list, you probably saw it, about the three phases. He talked about print democracy,
right.
Then he talked about electric or electronic democracy, and then digital democracy.
Right.
Now, I think he basically said print democracy is people representing and sharing opinions.
Right.
He saw the electric democracy is more a passive consumption of images.
Right.
Then he said the digital democracy is where everybody becomes a producer.
Right.
Now, where his terms are too simple, and he's not a good student of McLuhan, he hasn't read enough of it, and I'll say that to his face or anybody, he's been very irresponsible in representing the McLuhan point of view, which he thinks he does, on the Media Ecology list, and you didn't know enough about it, so you kind of supported him. But anyways, let's take what he said. Yes, print democracy is visual representation, one man, one vote, ballot box, and around opinions and statements. When he says that the electric democracy of the 50s, 60s is passive and consumer, he got it wrong. It is totally producer-consumer. This is what McLuhan pointed out, nobody got. That what people thought was a passive response to television was an active producer response, not only on the sensory level and the tactile involvement with the screen, but the population jumped in, ignored opinions, and went for images. Why does My Lai and these various scandals show up? Because they represent a refutation of humanist goals of the war agenda, but those Americans who thought that that guy who represented the My Lai massacre was correct in upholding the American thrust into Vietnam, they took that image and celebrated it. So you had the beginning of the culture war in the 70s, 80s over the so-called conservative, the right and the left, over images, and everybody was retreating into celebrating the image they identified with for the various demographic reasons. So the actual electronic era is very... It's so noisy, eventually Congress and Washington got timid and said, yeah, we've got to stop this stuff and have bipartisan politics. So Stallman's categorization of the producer level, he says in the digital, actually is in the electronic. So he's got the producer phase, one phase too further. He should put in the TV phase. Now, what is the digital democracy? That is the machines or the environments or the media coming alive and arguing among themselves and no chemical body involvement. Everybody is on the sidelines. Until Web 2.0 with YouTube, then the people could come in and affect the 2006 election. So it is terroristic or guerrilla kind of production that comes in with the digital. But production as a general term is already happening in the electric phase. So Mark's terms are not adequate to describe it. Now, I say right now, the digital has collapsed, has reached this gridlock that Croker talks about, and I could go into a few quotes, maybe we'll do it later if we have time, but the point is we are definitely into the post-information, post-communication, post-political, post-image reality, which could be the mystery landscape becoming a figure. And so when you talk about moving into a retrieval of creativity or whatever other values you hoiked up there, that's literate and maybe even TV bodies values, they are not the values of the present. Another aspect about Occupy is they don't communicate. And the reason the Android meme collapsed in 2008 financially is because the banks could not talk to each other and trust each other anymore. They lost the ability to be producer consumers and have a sense of rhythm with it and felt that they knew what was in chance, what was happening. And actually during the digital phase is what McLuhan said in 1972 is the phase of anticipatory democracy. That's tetrad management, and then the Android meme takes over tetrad management, and that CIA controlled everything. Everybody knew the press was really controlled by the CIA in the Reagan era. The old journalists would complain about that, but they didn't understand that it was just mere anticipatory democracy because the elites had to manage the confusion and many environments of the global theater. It was so complex that it could not be left up with voting or even corporate interference. It was an elite. And this is like The X-Files or The Fringe. All these science fiction movies are showing that syndrome that an elite manages a society. And McLuhan said that the large-scale patterns are run by and created by elites. That has what's broken down, Paul. In other words,
I agree with a lot of that, but several, you know.
You should agree with 100% of it and more, and add to it.
I don't think I should. Well, but nonetheless,
I'm sorry to shit on you, as McClure would say.
Yeah, it's impressive that I even agree with most of it, because I don't usually do.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, but here's, you know, our points of disagreement. The difference between the 1960s and now is precisely the difference between the global village, as McLuhan described it, in 1962, and the global village in 2011. In 1962, the global village is metaphoric. It's a prediction. There is, in fact, no global village in 1962. At most, there's maybe a series of national villages when you have people watching television, you know, the same television show in the same country, and even that's not a village because it's not interactive. So that's why what in the 1960s was in effect just, you know, utopian idealism without a grounding in palpable reality, without a wherewithal to make that happen. Now in 2011, there is the wherewithal to make that happen.
Okay, now this is where Andrew comes in, because Andrew, I assume you haven't read his paper. He summed up the McLuhan Centenary. It was something he wrote a couple of years ago, summarizing his PhD. But it builds on a structure that I laid out recently. Here is what we have. This is the forensics of the environmental hoods. The global village is one kind of hood. So here are the environmental hoods. The global village happened from 1840 to 1900. That's telegraphic conditions. And you see this on the back of the Laws of Media hardcover. Maybe it's on the soft cover. You see the tetrad for radio. And you see that the global village happens during the radio era. Okay? So now you as a humanist are projecting certain qualifiers to make it really literally a global village. When we could get into distinctions, but I think you're missing the point that from 1910 to 1960 was not the global theater, it was the solar theater. And then from 1970 to 1990, we were in the environment of the universal membrane that was caused by automation and computers. And then from 1995 to 2010, we were in the mythic erogenous zone. Now, people, they don't know about the global theater term. Maybe a few media ecologists do, because they were forced to read McLuhan in the revival in the 90s, so they caught up, oh, it's not a global village, it's a global theater. But Marshall writes in his foreword to William Bryan Key's Subliminal Seduction, 1973, you know, the year that you're getting involved with Murray the K, and I'm looking at Wolf Ben Jack with a bunch of six-year-olds, that's the year of the single erogenous zone. That's what Marshall says we're living in, a single erogenous zone in 1973. Now, I call it the mythic erogenous zone because by the time you get the Android meme mingling with everybody pentatically, then you don't even know what sex is anymore. And sex could be any interaction with any extension or sense. All right? So it's a mythic erogenous zone. What we're realizing this year, right now, I call it, I name it, the millennial ecstatics of five-bodied expressions. This is what's happening during the year of the Jubilee, this year. Occupy Wall Street is one aspect of a millennial ecstatic of five-bodied experience. So I'm willing, that's my grid, that's how I work with this. Andrew's paper backs me up on this. Now, let's go into what you mean by global village and the details to see if we can even apply what you mean to the present, all right?
Okay. You want to know what I think of as global village?
Yes. Okay. What are the characteristics that you're saying was just a dream in the 60s and is now getting close, whereas I'm talking about it happening in the 19th century?
Okay. It is a world in which it doesn't matter what part of the globe you live in, you have more or less equal access to all the information in the world. It is a world in which, and I was talking about this probably well before Mark Stallman was, this is one of the things I talk about in New Media, it's a world in which there is no difference anymore between consumer and producer, because the very technologies that you have to consume instantly and almost effortlessly enable you to produce. So this is another way. In 1962 and the 1960s, these national villages were voyeuristic villages. In other words, all you could do is watch, observe, be a witness to some kind of message that was being sent out, but you couldn't add to or produce. Or
you couldn't verbally interact, but Marshall, this is what you're missing, McLuhan's main point, but people sensorily participated in making the image, which made them think that they could start doing their own thing.
Yes, I absolutely. There's no doubt that's why McLuhan said television is a tactile medium, and it was through the tactile sense that people were shaping the images, but they were doing it individually. They were not doing it in any kind of community fashion. And so, again, the village is not just a series of distinct individuals who are creating. The village is a place in which people can create individually, but almost effortlessly can get together in groups, and you can mix and match, and you can shake and bake, and you can have a small group, a big group. It can be a huge group of millions of people. It can be a group of 2-3 people. It doesn't matter, again, who you are, what your age is, even who you are. That's, you know, what the village is like when it's working. That didn't exist at all through any media in the 1960s. So
okay, now you know, wait a minute. Now you know McLuhan was saying that it did exist, and he would call it tribal or retriever oral space, or say that it's a world of ESP or caveman world. He was trying to point out that all the things that you say about the global village that could be was actually happening in the 60s, 70s. It's the, what is it? You're talking about access to information, and the way you described it and everybody's sharing it, that's a world of ESP. Everybody knows the same thing, right?
Yes, now, absolutely, yes, I agree.
Now,
I
here's sure. The point, though.
ESP is a good way of...
No, it isn't. Now, here's the point. You read Ecclesia Archetype, McLuhan points out that most people think ESP in 19th century terms of matching. Everybody's in the same space, matching on the same page. And that is not fully tactile ESP, because real ESP is somehow intuiting a situation where everybody's blocking each other. Okay? So the matching aspect of ESP is not what I'm limiting my ESP definition to. And you as a literate person are putting a matching thing on the image of Global Village.
No, I'm not saying people have to match. That's why I said people can do pretty much anything they please, in today's Global Village. So I agree with you. It is an old-fashioned, antiquated concept to think of ESP as, you know, two people see the same...
Sharing the same page.
Yeah. Exactly. No, I'm not, suggesting...
You're emphasizing the making part. The making. Yes. Now, people felt they could do that when they started taking drugs and LSD. They said, oh, man, we're in a making world. So a lot of this making was going on. What is different is you have the Android meme or the chip landscape coming alive and providing a space that everybody can play in, hallucinate in, make and match in, but it is not there. What is that space? It is made by humans, but it seems to dominate or control humans. And that's what the old-fashioned fogies worry about. These kids are becoming cyborg and nanobots, and they don't like it. And the young kids have no problem with it. We have to say what our terms are, whether they're a literate projection, as you seem to be making, compared to the utopia that's been happening for 30 years. Because with cable TV, people could do what you're talking about. They could trade cassettes, tape cassettes, audio cassettes. How much of boiling of sharing the same space, the frog in the boiling pot, how much are we going to say we've arrived there? McLuhan felt that James Joyce was showing the most fantastic form of interaction. It was happening in the radio era. So we have to really understand how our most fantastic science fiction visions were already realized in the radio and TV era. And you see when he reviews people like William Burroughs, he points that out. He says the universe had an orgasm, the whole universe had an orgasm in the end of the 19th century. You've got, and as a science fiction novelist yourself, I haven't read any of them, but I would suspect they are rearview mirror images unless you begin to do science fiction from the starting point of McLuhan. Right? There's like...
Well, yes, but a couple things. First of all, what could happen in the era of cable and the sharing of...
How much sharing do you want to have shared? See,
yes,
you're saying...
But that is not at all the same because it's nothing like the human nervous system. I mean, this gets back, as I'm sure you know...
Well, that's the universal membrane. That's
exactly. To Nathaniel Hawthorne, when he looked at, the world in the 1840s, and he said it's turning into one big brain because of the telegraph. What is absolutely essential for the global village to be real, as I see it, is information communicated at the speed of light, because it is only then that on a worldwide level, the exchange of information, not necessarily the matching, but just the exchange in all of its connotations and usage at all approximates what goes on inside of every brain. So
okay, now let me respond to that, Paul. First of all, McLuhan said we didn't live at the speed of light. He said that, in his one phase back communications to the audience, one phase back, but he said we live at the speed of thought, and that's the digital era, life at the speed of thought. And then the other point, I forgot, so carry on.
A little bit to actually, I agree with you. I was just saying where we are now. I think ultimately the fastest speed in the universe is the speed of imagination or the speed of thought.
Oh, yeah, that's what I wanted to say. You're missing the disconnecting part. People are not the Android meme allows everybody to create their own space. And so there's no more exchange of information. This is what Baudrillard got with his 1987 book, The Ecstasy of Communication. The Ecstasy of Communication. Then Croker builds on that. And the fact that there's no communicating and no information is more symptomatic of the chip body. What is new is the chip body and the TV body are shrinking. They're so small that people think that they've retrieved their chemical bodies. And that's the misnomer of the Occupy. We haven't retrieved the 99% dominance of the chemical body, because the four bodies are still there. And that's the main point the journalists say to the occupiers. You guys reject technology in the old media, but you're using computers to stay in touch, and it's what started you. So the journalist knows the chip body. That what's different today is the chip body has shrunk. It's no longer the Leviathan of the 1670s under IBM conditions. The holopathic shrinking of the global hologram is leading to millennial ecstatics of misinterpretation or pro-interpretation. Don't even want to judge it, but they're missing the fact that we're not retrieving the global. You're actually advocating celebrating the retrieval of the global village of the 19th century or of, well, maybe the 15th century. Before literacy, where there were small villages and people were in touch with each other, and their bodies, physical bodies, seemed to be the major container. People are missing the point. They're misidentifying the retrieval of the chemical body and its hugeness by thinking that the other technologies disappeared. No, they're even bigger than the chemical body that appears to be retrieved because they're there, but they're invisible. So that holopathic dimension is what I think you're not including in the complexity of this situation.
All right, well, but what I think you're missing, and I don't understand why you say this, a very crucial part of your schema, and this is like the second or third time you mentioned this, is that the chip body, the digital age, isolates us because people get into their own realms and are, in fact, not communicating, not sharing. Everything that I've seen, both on an individual, personal, everyday level and on, you know, larger levels such as, you know, groups of students and so on, everything that I've experienced goes in exactly the contrary way.
You're talking about particular things that are shared.
What'd you say?
You're talking about particular things that are shared.
I'm talking about the propensity for sharing. I mean, what is Facebook and Twitter? I mean, the literary critics are quick to say, oh, so much of, you know, Twitter is just trivial nonsense. You know, who cares?
Right, they're missing the phatic mania, phatic.
Exactly. But okay, that's right. But it seems to me that undoubtedly there's a profound sharing that's going on, and that's why, back to what you said about we're in a lonely well at the very beginning. Although I'm not sure if that was.
Yeah, I was quoting the radio. He said it was a song. I'm All Alone by the Telephone was a song in the 20s and 30s. The well of loneliness that the radio acoustic space did to industrial societies.
Okay, but I think that we're not in that well now. I mean, that's been...
No, we're not.
We're less lonely than we've ever been in history because we can communicate to anyone that we want to just about any time.
Right, but that what is the effect of that? We can engage in older media, speech, eyeball stuff, all the physical senses can be shared, but we're inside the Android meme, which is this invisible environment that's running everything, destroying everything, and enhancing everything, and it's the chemical body is not engaged in the sharing. People are sharing their TV aspects and chip aspects. But what they're trying to get is to share what they call a nostalgic, the chemical body, and I say that's the living museum of the human form. They're trying to retrieve it, and this is what they're missing.
Well, but the difference between you and me on this is that I think Occupy Wall Street shows that at least in one significant dimension, they are getting their physical bodies back together. I mean, this is a point I was making.
No, that's the point. Okay, that's the reason they gather. Again, the audience even knows more than they understand. The chemical body knows that it can't get back together get back together in a shared chemical space. So it nervously huddles and says, let's not worry about what different opinions are. If anybody tries to divide us, ignore them. Let's stay together. They're nervously trying to reinforce the chemical body social connection, but it's done nervously, and they do it neurotically. They just stay there and just sit there, which is a stupid way to live. But they're trying to protect that image.
Yes, I agree. There's a lot of that there. But the question is that the end point of this, or is it the beginning? And again, here we go again, you know, with half empty, half full, optimist, all that stuff. I see it as just the beginning. You know, the old, you know, lots of jokes, you know, about optimists and pessimists. But I'll tell you one of my favorite jokes that my father, for some reason, told me years ago. A father has two sons, twins, one of whom is an optimist and the other is a pessimist. And he's trying to figure out, he wants to basically get both of them to be better balanced, apparently. So he thinks a lot of what kind of birthday presents to give them. So what he does is he gives the pessimistic son a pony. You know, it's like an old Victorian story, probably.
Yeah.
And so he gives the, and he comes in, like, you know, a couple hours after the son's given the pony, and he sees the son is sitting there crying his eyes out. And the father says, what's the matter? I gave you a pony. I mean, isn't that great? And he said, yes, I was so happy when you first gave it to me, but then I was thinking, I'll get on it, and I'll start riding, and it'll probably throw me off, and I'll hit my head, and I'll get killed, and you and mommy will be so upset. So
right.
Okay, great. So it turns out that he gave the optimistic son a big pile of horse manure, because what's more depressing than that for his birthday? It's a big pile of horse.
Yeah,
manure.
Yeah.
And he walks to the optimistic son's room, and the optimistic son's like happily whistling away. He's happy. He's dancing around. And the father says, "Son, look, I'm sorry. I was trying to make a point, but you know what the hell are you so happy about?" The son says, "Are you kidding, Dad? I mean, I was upset when I first saw this pile of horse manure, but I realized that there's horse manure. There could be a horseshoe here." And it could be some kind of, you know, magic horseshoe, and I'll get rich. I'll be there forever.
Okay, that's a good joke. That's a good. Everybody's looking at the pile of shit known the Occupy Parks, right? And they're wondering, is there a horse there or is it manure? And some are saying this is going to go, and this is not going to go. Now I say the Android meme tries to look like a human being. And so they're imitating all these things. So we're actually seeing the Andor memes interpretation of this dilemma around the Occupy movement. You see? So where is the human being? What is the human being? Which body is the human? Which is dominant? That's the mystery landscape that's showing up. So as McLuhan said, we back in the 60s, because of television, we have retrieved the way they experienced Athens, Greece, the time of the phonetic alphabet, where everybody said, wow, we don't know what's going on anymore. We got this new visual space. We're not even aware of it, and we got to figure out our relationship to it. The interrogative question comes back into daily life. We're back here now on a new level watching the Android meme present these images about its own questioning about whether it's on the right course or not. That's what I'm saying, is that the world of language, and you talk about sharing, that happened with speech. Speech shares everything, all right? And McLuhan said that in the end, all media are words. In the end, the original medium, which is the most tactile medium, was speech. But that is gestural speech, not just what comes out of your mouth. So this tactile reality, I wanted to mention about the economist point. Take today's masterpiece, The Hidden Masterpiece in Economics.
Yes.
He crystallizes the meaning of that book in his great Wall Street New York Times op-ed, September 21st, 1974, A Media Approach to Inflation. That predicts the whole 70s, 80s, and 90s, the whole gamut, he predicts it. And he says it's a post-tactile world when you get into this computer situation. I say the post-tactile world has collapsed. So we are at the most phenomenal, unbelievable, uncommunicable situation that anybody could ever fucking talk about right now.
Yes, well, however, again, I see that with an optimistic edge. Because
but what does that mean? You think, we'll have 5 billion people. Maybe 2 billion will be wiped out, but we're not going to have just 100,000. We're going to have still 5 billion still living here.
Here's what I mean, and here basically is the key point. In the end, you're saying that to some extent the physicality of Occupy Wall Street is an illusion. But here's why I think it's not, okay? In the end, here are the things, and this gets back to just, you know, the common basis. What defines physicality?
There is no common basis, Paul.
Yeah.
That's literate. That's universalism. You tell me what is a good, what will be the content of an optimistic turnout? Of an optimistic, okay, give me the content of that.
All right. First of all, though, the facets are, can people have sex? You can't have, okay, if you can have physical procreative sex, that means you're there in person. You can't do that digitally. You can have sex online, but that doesn't result in anything. It might be
Wait a minute. As they get, you remember the TV show Wild Palms? Remember when you can start having the hologram come to you, and this is in 93?
Yeah.
And you can have sex with it. Now, that's going to happen. So you're nostalgic for chemical body sex.
Yeah, but it's not true chemical body sex because, again, you can't really – nothing really results from it except fun. But the other thing is food. You know, Karl Popper made the point that our most profound interaction with reality – he made this point in Objective Knowledge – one of his best books is when we ingest food, because we're taking material from the physical world and it's becoming literally part of us. And that's the other thing about Occupy Wall Street. In the living there, they're eating together, they're being together. That's why I think it's in effect more real than what you are saying.
Because they're being there and they can't bathe, or they're going to get sick. And who would want to? There's no way anybody of reasonable apprehension would want to sit in that park.
It's not as first of all, I haven't been there, so I can't speak.
None of us have been there. It's a virtual space on the end of
it. I was there actually once back in September, very briefly. But the fact is, I haven't lived there, and so I agree that I can't tell you from firsthand experience. But from everything I've read and seen and heard about it, they have a library there. By the way, that was one of the first things that the criminal New York City cops did when they dispersed the parks. The people in the park, they basically took the books, like Hitlerians, and they didn't burn them, but they took their books away because they were trying to destroy their sense of community. But the fact that there are books there, and the fact that there are kitchens there that produce food. I've seen these people.
Well, those are archetypal human activities. This nostalgia. They're saying, look, this is what humans do when they just have chemical bodies. They read books and share food. I mean, that's a museum. That's not the way to run a digital economy or a post-digital economy, or it has nothing to do with it.
You're completely right. It's not the way to run it. But what I'm saying is it's the beginning.
It's not a beginning. How could it be a beginning? I think you're trying to say that if we all recognize that we were all individual chemical bodies with no ID labels, no nationality, the hippie commune, global commune dream, if we all recognize we're just people, and why don't we get along? Isn't that all you're hoiking here?
No, that makes me sound even more simplistic and idealistic.
Yeah, you sound very simplistic.
I know. Well, here's what I'm really saying.
Complexify, Paul. Complexify.
Make it more complex. If you think about, the direct democracy in ancient Athens, there are a lot of things wrong with it. Obviously, it put Socrates to death. Most people really were not able to participate in it because, the notion of citizen was very carefully constricted. But nonetheless, it did have something going, which is that whoever the citizens were, they could get together and talk, and that's how laws were passed, and that's how the
And they lost. They got wiped out because the hidden effects of visuality led to the Roman Empire.
Yeah. Yes, that's absolutely true. But something was lost when they were wiped out. And what
something was lost when they thought they were gaining something.
Well, I think they did gain some stuff. I mean, that's why there was some great philosophy, great plays, great...
Oh, that's all literacy. There's nothing great in it. I would never read a book again. Book is such a limiting, reductionist experience compared to the multimedia I live. I only do the book when I look at Finnegan's Wake because it reminds me how fucking stupid books are. That's the only book I'll look at.
That's the best that they could do back then. But that's precisely, you're making my point, because now we can recall some of that direct democracy, and this isn't really simple at all, but that direct democracy will be embedded in electronic...
Direct democracy allows people to all contribute and create a lot of noise. You're going to scream out for the ivory tower, which is already happening. That's what we call CIA-run world, which is what McLuhan said. It's a James Bond world in the 60s. The Tetrad managers by the android meme is where we're at, and they're the ones having the crisis, not human beings. The one percenters are having the crisis, and I'm proud to be a one percenter. And if you want to have a successful dream that you're talking about, everybody come and occupy Maui. You could actually pull it off here in Maui. You got a perfect day every day. You got a beach to bathe in. So unless you're in Maui, you can't pull it off this way. But anyway, it's the digital management of this technology. Now remember what Croker says, and this is 20 years ago before the internet even showed up. He said, this, 20 years ago, he said that the genes use the physical chemical bodies as a temporary vehicle till they could get to the data space, the chip landscape, and merge with that. We're witnessing genes leave the chemical body and merge with the data space. Now, you've never heard that said, but that's partly what McLuhan was getting at when he said biology had an orgasm in the end of the 20th century. Now, here, take this thing, information. So let me just read. I want to get a bit of Croker in, so let's look at this. Page 148. He talks about data deflation and data inflation. Now, this is what these kids are up against. I mean, remember, through the TV body, it's fun to have the Occupy fad for a couple months, but the reason that's going to be beat up right now is because the TV consumers are sick of that story. They want a new story, all right? And that's a factor in the TV landscape. Give me a new story, a new scenario. And so Bloomberg waited for that cycle, and now he can beat them up. Okay, so this data deflation, data inflation. So Croker goes, data deflation, that's the state of information depression where data is driven towards its referential extreme. So even take any event like Occupy. Approaching the planetary referent of meaning, so is there any meaning in the Occupy Wall Street movement? Approaching the planetary referent of meaning, information falls out of its high trajectory orbit and comes under the fiery gravitational pull of history. At this point, the information bank undergoes a depression-like crash with a classic run on the always potentially bankrupt information bank by the waiting crowd of data creditors. At the degree zero of the transparency of meaning, information loses its degrees of freedom, is stripped of its cybernetic means of circulation, suicides itself by falling into a pure use value, and that's really what the Occupy guys are trying to get, pure use value, and flops back into the referent of meaning that it thought it had escaped forever. In the state of information depression, the value, in brackets, the value of meaning overwhelms the sign of data, and information is not allowed to circulate freely as a cybernetic medium of exchange. So that's what Bloomberg, he's going to try to bring it into, not allow this circulation right now. Think of authoritarian politics, in brackets, contemporary China or the USSR before the fall of the information wall. In these cases, the political control of information exchange cancels out data as a freely circulating medium of exchange. As a result, information is politically forced towards the gold standard of a state-administered meaning system. Okay? That's what they're trying, Bloomberg's trying to bring in the meaning of this. It's disease, the Zuccotti lung. Information depression is a state of oxygen starvation for a digital culture, a narrow bandwidth for an anti-virtual society with pure history but no digital signal. Okay, bear with me. Now, that's data deflation. What happens during data inflation? That's the triumph of communication over information depression. So he's positing a polarity of communication versus information. Not data under the political sign of use value, but a world oversaturated by information to such excess that it becomes pure signal. A state of, quote, pure virtualities, unquote. Information inflation is typified by the transformation of all the reference into freely circulating cybernetic media of exchange. Here, the gold standard of referential meaning is abandoned forever, and data approaches the maximal exchange represented by the over-authorization of the pure sign of information and the under-authorization of the coordinative standard of meaning. In periods of information inflation, pattern maintenance is continually destabilized. A world oversaturated by data finally breaks beyond a consumer model of information with its market-steered models of scarcity of supply and purchasing power, and instead falls under the sign of excremental data, that's shit data, information that is as a site of imminent cancellation, exterminism, and liquidation. While the state of information depression is characterized by a scarcity of information, but a surplus of politically controlled meaning, periods of information inflation are typified by a hyper-scarcity of encryption keys or meaning, but a hyper-saturation of pure data. Communication is the antithesis of meaning, as much as pure data reverses pure history. Now, that whole two paragraphs is phenomenal writing, done before Wired magazine started, before everybody got on the internet in 95, and it is equally complex, a stunner, as McLuhan's prose was in the 50s and 60s. Would you disagree with that statement?
Yes, completely.
Okay, give me the rebuttal.
Here's why. I think neither of those two things, you know, data deflation or data inflation, are even remotely like what has happened. I mean, the only thing I'll give Kroker is that he wrote that, as you pointed out, before the digital age became reality. And what is that reality in the digital age? In the first place, let's just look at this notion of information saturation or information overload. There never was such a thing, and in fact, there never will be such a thing for two very important reasons. Number one, the human brain seems to have almost an infinite capacity to multitask, you know, and handle a lot of different kinds of information. The only time, in fact, we feel overwhelmed is when we don't have enough information to navigate a system that we find ourselves thrown into. So if for example, you think about, to use two old-fashioned examples, you walk into a bookstore or you walk into a library. Now, there are vastly more books there than any of us could possibly read in a lifetime, not to mention the time that we're in a bookstore and trying to decide what to buy, or in a library and trying to decide what to read. But we don't feel the least bit overwhelmed, and not much more than maybe a tinge of momentary anxiety. Why? Because we have the navigational information that's necessary to navigate those two environments. And so we're perfectly fine. What causes the sense of being overwhelmed is because we don't have enough information to deal with the information choices and possibilities that we have. So therefore, this notion of being saturated, too much information, I think you can systematically show how the bad things that have happened, whatever they may be, at any time and place is almost always because there was too little information.
So what do you mean by information there? Too little? I think you mean the correct pattern or something, or the correct filter.
Yeah, no, what I mean is we don't have enough. Sometimes it's just a question of simple content. I mean, if you think about, here, an example, the Battle of New Orleans is fought after the treaty has been signed, ending the War of 1812. But it's signed in Paris, and in those days, information moved so slowly by today's standards. The fastest way you could get information from Paris to America was to put it on a boat. It would take 3 or 4 weeks, and that was not in time to stop the Battle of New Orleans. So that's like an archaic, but still, I think, worthwhile example of what happens when you don't have enough information.
That means you don't have the appropriate medium.
Yes, that's right. And that's why more faster media are always better, as long as you have control over what's sent over the media. The problem with the television body, as you call it, or what I would call the age of mass media, or electronic in contrast to digital media, is that the information moved quickly, but it was only moving one way, from a minuscule number of senders to a mass number of consumers or receivers. And even though I agree with you and McLuhan that we, the consumers, always help shape the image, nonetheless, still, we were not in any position of control, and now we are.
Now that's a good point. We're in control in terms of I can project my own messages, old-fashioned verbal printed and imagistic images to people, but I'm not in control of the Android meme, which is acting out its own identity crisis of panic, hysteria, schizophrenia, and paranoia. We're witnessing the global theater, which then became the mythic Garage Notes, have its own freakout as it attempts to become a human. So we're not having information overload. The Android meme is acting out its bias that humans have information overload. That's what we're panicked by.
Maybe, but I don't see this as being panicked. And also, I don't know if I agree with it. I think I probably don't, because I'm not even 100% sure if I understand what you mean by this. I have never bought the idea of autonomous technology. And so if you're saying that the Android meme operates on its own, there is no such thing. Technologies operate due to human direction. The only question is how many humans direct it and who are the humans who direct it.
So you're missing the ludicrous image of life that Marshall, as a satirist, developed. It always was. You know, people start smoking cigars, and then he said, then the cigars start smoking the people. And unaware people, and every culture is unaware in retrospect, They let the culture take over, and there never was any control when there's not enough perceptive people or situations. And McLuhan said only because the TV or the global theater came along and provided so many patterns that people had to get they got disconnected. They couldn't identify with any particular medium they were familiar with. Only that starts to make people aware of the uncontrolled factor of media. People always thought they were in charge. And McLuhan's joke is, and humor is, they aren't. And novels and McLuhan show that, you know, the Marx Brothers vision.
However, I think of that, I agree completely that when McLuhan was writing in...
Not completely, maybe 51%. Okay, there's never any completion.
Fair enough. 78%.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
That 79%, I'll give you that. Okay.
All right, that was your big year in 79 when McLuhan left the voicemail. Yeah, I know, it was a good year.
There you go, it's a good number.
Yeah, sorry, but
when he was writing and thinking, you're right, the idea that people were in control was an illusion. My point is, in the digital age, it has moved to some extent, again, not completely, you're right, because nothing is complete, but to a significant extent from illusion to reality. But one thing I want to quickly point out...
But you would probably agree it's very hard to describe what the control is that people have arrived at.
Well, what the expressions of it are the success of the Tea Party, in as much as they did have some success, which was basically whatever anyone's politics is, the Tea Party was a revolt against traditional representative democracy. It was saying both the Republican and the Democrat Party are not answering our needs. And again, we've yet to see the results of Occupy Wall Street, but I think we're at the beginning. But I just want to make a quick point about Jacques Ellul vis-a-vis Marshall McLuhan, and because I forgot to mention it before, and it's pertinent to this. You made a very good point, which I completely agree with, that McLuhan was the rare, almost unique writer who realized the inadequacies and the paradoxes of the very things he was doing. So,
yeah.
You know, he knew completely. He's writing a book, The Gutenberg Galaxy, Understanding Media, to explain how that kind of medium was in many ways bygone even then. And he was very much aware of it, and that's one of the things that made him so extraordinary. But you can clearly see the difference then between McLuhan and someone like Jacques Ellul, who writes a book, The Technological Society, which condemns every technology, I mean, all across the board, in your terms, the chemical body, everything. It's like a hopeless case with flies stuck like flypaper. Everything is propaganda.
He's a Gnostic in that sense, you know, it's a fallen world.
Yeah, and he blithely publishes this in a book. So, I mean, it seems to have no even, you know, scintilla of a qualm that he is writing a book, which is a form of technology, that's talking about the propaganda.
Yeah, and it's a disgrace that Lance Straight named a prize after him in the Media College Association. He should not even be mentioned.
There you go. I would agree with you completely. I had a big argument with Lance about this
But Ellul did make the concept, the conceptual point, that the propaganda was not the message, but the culture in action. And that's what Marshall took from that, and that was good. That was another way of saying the medium is the message.
I agree. And in that sense, Ellul was better than Mumford, who naively thought...
Yeah. Every one of those fucking guys prized by Lance and them. It was disgusting. You should have only one prize for McLuhan and maybe the latest phenomenon, whatever, the Lady Gaga. There should be a Lady Gaga. Who's approached the communication skills of Lady Gaga this year? They like to hoik out Doug Reschkopf, but he's miserable. He's actually moving towards the Mumford view. He's so depressed now. No, the Ellul thing. He's a recent interview. He says, I have no meaning anymore. It doesn't mean... You never admit that you're a pessimist or optimist in public. That's what you should recognize.
I know. Well, but no, listen, I always say that I'm an optimist in public because, you know, fuck it. I'm an optimist.
Well, no, because you're a radio guy. You're Murray McKay. You're always on the promo. You're an Alan Free. You know, hey, another party's coming soon.
It's Murray McKay with the
singing song. Yeah. Oh, social criticism is autobiographical, and we're hearing your biography sung to us right now.
There you go.
Yeah. So we maybe come to you're siding with the simplistic universal outcome, and I'm emphasizing the complexification. Now they both have services and disservices, both approaches, right?
Right, except I don't think mine is simplistic. I think I'm siding with the correct optimistic outcome.
Okay, what would that be? What you're trying to say, I'm not simplistic, I'm complex. I acknowledge the complex, but I ridiculously or instinctively say, this is going to work out. Somehow you're, what are you relying on there, an emotion? I wonder what that is.
No, I'll tell you what it is, okay? People often ask me that, and here's what it is. Who won World War II? Basically, we did. We beat the Nazis.
No, IG Farben. But the we, Rockefellers, yeah, owned IG Farben, so the Global Village won, the global corporate elite.
That's
Big
right.
Brother won. Big Brother won.
Well, no, Big Brother didn't win. I mean, basically, there was a potential for Big Brother, but basically, in those years, by today's standards, there was no such thing as a really progressive society, but the more progressive society beat the more retrograde society. Why am I optimistic? Because we won World War II. Why am I optimistic? Because, again, the more progressive society, which by no means was perfect, had a lot of problems, we survived and the Soviet Union collapsed. That says to me that there is something in the evolution of human society, in the evolution of media, which leads to better situations.
Okay. Oh, yeah, Soviet Union, maybe bad scene, but what is everybody complaining about? The winners fucked it up over the last 20 years.
Well, we did, no doubt about it. So therefore, you know, I would agree with you completely. It would be simplistic if I was somehow saying, hey, you know, lying down on the road.
You're on the yellow brick road now. Well, that's what everybody felt in 93, 94, the Wired magazine ethos, that, you know, that techno-utopianism that the digital environment certainly evoked in people.
That's right.
That was a mood for a couple of minutes there, and, of course, it quickly flipped by the late 90s. Into a disaster, and then we have one disaster after another. At the same time, on the individual level, there's been nothing more glorious in terms of what the universal erogenous zone can experience. I mean, this media environment we live in over the last 5 or 10 years is fantastic. It's the greatest experience if you've got time to enjoy it, which I do have myself. But, I mean, this is the best time ever happened, but I'm not attributing to anybody that claims they caused it.
Well, nobody caused it in particular, but, you know, I mean...
Yeah, who did cause it? What did cause it?
Well, what caused it was, and this gets back to the very first thing we discussed, well, one of the first things, how did McLuhan understand in the 1960s a significant part of what's going on right now?
He understood. He wrote an article on how the economy will have huge abundance. He predicted the abundance from 82 to 2008.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, what is, you know, driving this is a fundamental aspect of human being, which, you know, yearns for more freedom, yearns for more satisfaction, and when those yearnings, and many other yearnings as well, are able to be better expressed and implemented and actualized, by and large, things improve. But I do agree with you, you know, about this. Nobody knows where the hell we came from. There really is no explanation.
We don't even know if there was a beginning.
Right. I mean, the word beginning doesn't even make sense because because that assumes we know what was before the beginning. I mean, the whole thing is paradoxical, and therefore nobody knows, and I agree with you completely on this, no one knows exactly, precisely anything at all like that where we're headed. But all that I'm saying is in a very clumsy, inexact, imperfect, fumbling, stumbling fashion, we are moving towards something better.
The muddle crass. In other words, the middle class never disappeared, just turned into the muddle crass and its services.
Well, muddled is great, but if it's the muddled class, that comprises...
No, muddled crass. C-R, this is a line from Joyce. Crass, okay. C-R-A-S-S, muddled crass. Okay, I want to bring in, it's probably never been said, Canetti's Law. Now, McLuhan talked about this in the 70s. You know Elias Canetti, Crowds and Power?
Yes.
McLuhan said there's an interesting phenomenon in crowds, and a crowd can be a grouping of media. He says crowds, as they get bigger... They think the constituents of the crowd, they think they're getting smaller, and they start to panic. So the wealth of the George Bush era, you know, the naughty knots, the incredible wealth, the crowd was just expanding in 2003, 4, 5, and 6, and then they did the Canetti Law. They flipped in to start thinking, no, this is too much, I can't take it. And so the economy and the exchange of ecstasy stopped. And that was the crisis of the mortgages, and all that happened in 2008. It was a fulfillment of the Kennedy Law that paradoxically, humorously, the crowd, as it gets better and better, the crowd then starts to think, no, it can't be stay better forever. Something's going to happen. You get my pattern here?
Yes, I think that's absolutely, that's a very good description. But by the way, what's going on now is not crowds the way I think Kennedy's Law was describing it and understood it, and McLuhan talked about it, because what's happening now is the individual members of the organization are much more sentient, not that more sentient and more that they're more intelligent, but more sentient in that they can express their intelligence in a way that in a traditional crowd you couldn't. The characteristics of a traditional crowd is a certain mindlessness.
That would be the chemical body crowd, yes. There's the digital bodies crowds.
That's right. You sacrifice something to be part of the crowd. But I think what the situation is now is you don't have to sacrifice much at all to be part of a group.
That's right. Now, here's McLuhan's point. This relates. He said in the 60s that mass man is not tribal. He knew that, and he writes about the increasing autonomy of people in their chemical body lives from chemical body pressures. Nobody knew what anybody was doing as it became hugely speed of life, speed of light, and speed of thought movements with cars and telephones. You didn't have, some people thought it was an impoverishment of community, but the service was no chemical body was subject to the crowd as much, and that's part of the collapse of religion and the authorities. Okay, that's the chemical body service. Now you have the digital situation. So when he says mass man is both individual and tribal voluntarily, when the Android meme comes in, the chip landscape, and replays all that, now YouTube, Web 2.0, is you can be part of many kinds of chemical astrobody or TV crowds voluntarily and drop out at any point. That is the most utopian situation where you can maintain your individuality or not subject to anybody, and yet enjoy the pleasures of sociality at the same time. So his prediction of mass man is not tribal but has an autonomous factor has been really abundantly rammed in everybody's face thanks to the Android meme. That's what you're trying to say.
Yes, exactly right. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Except there's nothing negative about that. In other words, you are presenting it with a slight.
No. I'm saying that the occupiers represent that tendency of the chip body begin to think it's getting too small.
Yes.
See, it's more a chip body panic going on as expressed in the occupiers. I'm saying if we don't have the proper understanding of what I'm saying, then you will make the mistake and think it's a bad scene. I'm not optimistic or pessimistic. I just say it's fucking great to be alive. Right now.
Well, I agree with you completely. It is always fucking great to be alive.
Right. It's always great to be alive. And I would not include myself as just a 99 percenter. I'm both 99 percenter and 1 percenter. And you need to have that complex, complementary kind of multi-awarenesses to survive today, to stay in your poise. And what the media will do, naturally, to create wealth is to make you feel upset on all kinds of things all the time or make you feel over-happy. The American Idol, when I look at that, it's almost impossible to look at as you watch the crowd dynamic of the judges, the way they have to act impressed. It's just sickening the way they look for a second, but I don't look at it very long. I mean, the Android meme is trying to make me upset because they're trying to show people worshiping the idol. The American singer.
I agree with you about that. By the way,
let's talk about Breaking Bad. I noticed that you wrote about that. Let's go into the meaning of that show.
Are we at a time check at this point? Like in the sense that trying to serve up something that is.
We don't know fucking time, man. We're just ecstatically exchanging inputs, and we want to talk about Breaking Bad right now. Wait, who are you?
Andrew, it's good to hear from you. I thought you fell asleep.
I thought you graduated. I thought you had a job. I went off and went somewhere.
Yeah, well, you're right about Breaking Bad. I mean, that does typify a lot of things. I just want to say, though, just in case this ends soon, I'm part of the 99% A. I wish I were part of the 1% B.
Oh, no, you are. You may not be financially, but everybody of the abundance of the chip landscape with, you know, Web 2.0, we are all trillionaires in terms of the wealth we can experience.
Well, that's true. I agree with you about that.
Do you know what the channel, the site letmewatchthis.ch? Ever been there?
No, that's a good name.
It's China knocking out Netflix and everybody. Every TV show, everything that ever happened, everything that's happening now, movies come out, they're on, let me watch this before they come out in the theaters. China's propped up this chip body abundance that's incredible. So go to letmewatchthis.ch to see the abundance of all the stuff you like to watch. And that brings up another point, Paul. How do you do all the science fiction? How do you do all this work, teaching, and at the same time blog and watch all these TV shows and then do this and that? How do you fit all that in? You must have at least three bodies.
Well, here's the answer. This is the honest truth. The thing that I like least in life is if I have a second with nothing to do. So that never happens.
So you do a lot of multitasking. You can prepare for your class while watching Breaking Bad?
Well, I can't actually be physically teaching a class and talking to students and watching Breaking
Bad. No, but you can prepare for a class or whatever you have to do.
Oh, right, yeah. Well, there's part of the answer is I don't prepare. I never prepare.
Oh, that's another aspect of the class of education. You know, in the 60s, art is anything you get away with? Today, society, including departments of education, is anything you can get away with. Because I know what you guys do in class. You guys are winging it. You're just talking. The kids show up to engage in chemical body verbal exchange phatically, and Andreas will deal with it. I know there ain't no fucking 19th century teaching going on there.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Winging it is the best thing. What would you rather do, crawl, walk, or fly? So I basically like winging it, absolutely right. I'll tell you a true story. I won't say where this was. But once, years ago, I was paid a lot of money, like in the multi thousands of dollars, to just give a talk. And I was flown out to this place. I'm not going to be any more specific than that.
Yeah.
I never, ever read from a paper when I talk. I talk. So,
right.
But I knew that these people, you know, would be unhappy if I just walked up to the stage.
And winged it. And looked like you were winging it.
That's right. So I basically took up a sheaf of papers. I printed out some bullshit on the first page. So and I brought that up to the podium, put it down in an ostentatious way, and proceeded to glance at it and rustle through the papers once or twice. But there wasn't a word in that in those written papers.
Yeah, you weren't as bold as me. In the March 28th, 1998, Legacy of McLuhan Conference at Lincoln Center, and then the other place. This is actually
there.
In the other. You
there.
Were there.
Yep.
In my talk, what did I do? I'd look at the page, look like I was reading from it, and then toss the page off the side. So as I went through my lecture, the pages are falling and floating all around. And the guy who ran the show said, "Oh, Bob's a performance theater," and a performance artist. And I said, "No, I vigorously protested that. There was a lot more going on, but I just want to say you couldn't go that far and have the pages drop."
No, I wasn't willing to go that far because obviously my luck, one of the pages was like sort of floated out to the audience and a horrified person would have looked at the page and see nothing. It would have been the ultimately cool page, but that person wouldn't have appreciated it.
No, that's right. Now, do you remember me? Were you there when I was dropping my pages? Do you remember that image once I say it?
No, I'll tell you why, because here's something else. With rare exceptions, the way I usually go to conferences, especially Fordham University, is I just go and I give my talk, and I stay for like maybe one talk afterwards, and that's pretty much it.
That's right. Frank Zingroni told me, and he was a longtime professor at York University in Toronto, he said he stopped going to conferences because nobody was really listening to each other. He just wouldn't go.
Yeah, well, see, he was right. Nobody listened.
Yeah.
Other conferences. So.
So I want to say that, so here's how I edit my talk, and it's on my timeline, you can hear it. I laid out all my stuff, and I said, "Now it'll take you guys another 25 years to understand what I just said."
Well, that's very good. That's very influential. Marshall would have loved that. Let me tell you another quick Marshall story. I love this, you know, being recorded somewhere for posterity. Right around that same period of time, I don't know, 77, 78, something like that, Marshall was coming down to NYU, and he was going to be conducting two things, a small seminar with some of our doctoral students and giving a talk to, like, a huge auditorium of everyone and their grandmother at NYU. So I say to Postman, so I assume I'm going to be in that small seminar. Neil Postman says, you really have had enough contact with McLuhan. We want to give other students a chance. So I said, what is this, some false sense of democracy? You know, how can I not be at that seminar? But that's the way it was. So then I'm talking to McLuhan, like the day before he's coming down to the conference, and Mark said, "Oh, Paul, I look forward to seeing you at the seminar as well as the large talk." And I proceeded to tell Marshall that, I'm not going going to be at the seminar. And Mark said, oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that. So now we're at the big talk because I didn't go to the seminar. And Mark was up there talking about, left brain, right brain, all the stuff he was talking about. And I think talking about the tetrad, and all the deans are there, the president of the university, Neil Postman, they're all sitting, beaming. You're in the front row. I'm somewhere, in the back. And, Marshall just so he had seen me when I walked in, and he sort of points to me and says, but there's somebody here at New York University who is really making some very, very important contributions to this tetrad and my work. And I can sort of see Neil sitting up. He's proud. He goes, yes, some really original contributions. That's Paul Levinson out there. So that was the one talk that I was very glad that I showed up for to listen to.
Yeah, you a lot of grudges and revenges were completed for you there, and I think we should end on that story. It makes you look good. We're here to make you look good, Paul, at least almost as good as me. But anyways, we'll make you look good. That's a good story to end on. So what do you think, Andrew? You want to say something, Andrew?
No, I'm just very happy that this session transpired. I think it'll go down on record as historic. I think we'll have horrified enough people and provided enough insight, and it's been spectacular, Paul. Spectacular.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Andrew, for inviting me. And, Bob, it's always been a pleasure. We have to do this more often.
I'll be calling you in the middle of the night like McLuhan and giving you my latest insights.
Anytime.
Okay. All right. So let's stop the recording. You can hold on, Paul. We'll just officially stop the recording.
Okay.
I got to go over here and pull this button off here just a second.